Welcome to the latest episode of Newsroom Insider. I'm reporter John Wells. In the first segment, called In the Groove, I'll chat with Mark McNeil, a musician who moonlights as a spectator reporter, about a story he has appearing in Saturday's Spec about another sign that vinyl, as in music, that's records, kids, is coming back. In the second segment, called Anonymous, we explore a topic in the news these days, in part thanks to a president by the name of Trump, the use of unnamed sources in journalism. Managing editor Jim Poling will be by to talk about the Spec's position on this. First up, In the Groove with Mark McNeil. Mark, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, John.
So you have a story in Saturday's paper that is perhaps another indication of the resurgence of the record music business, or is it? What's the story about?
Well, interestingly, there's a fellow in Hamilton, a guy named Doug Putnam, who bought into a company called Sunrise Records a few years ago, expanded it to 9 stores, and then this week announced that he's going to take over 70 HMV stores that had been closed down, that were liquidated. And front and center in these stores, he says, is going to be vinyl records. So the two counterintuitive things are the one that he's opening record stores at all, and the second that he's attaching his future to vinyl.
Right. Is this a big gamble for Sunrise?
It's huge, actually. You know, he's investing in the 7 digits. He won't say how much. But others are thinking that he's pretty smart, that he's riding this larger wave of kind of a pushback against computer technology, that increasingly people out there are coming to the conclusion that stuff that involves computers is not real, and they want to be able to touch things in a way that is non-digital, that is analog. And that's showing up in bookstores, independent bookstores. People going in, they want to see the books. They're not interested in Kindle. It's showing up in some circles. People are going back to film and Polaroid, and other ways as well. And so a lot of people like Doug are sitting back and saying, you know, this return to analog thing, this return to vinyl and all things analog, is got some legs, and there's some potential to make some money at it.
And certainly, I have records. For years I had them in my garage, and I think some of them got eaten by squirrels and so on, but in recent years I brought them back, the ones that survived, and I enjoy playing the records. I have a young daughter who likes playing records. Mm. There is the tactile experience, yeah. I guess, as you say, perhaps making something of a comeback. And certainly artists today release on vinyl, right?
Yeah, they do. And I think one of the things that somebody pointed out, there's a fellow who's written a book, a guy named David Sachs, called The Revenge of Analog, mm-hmm. Real Things and Why They Matter. And he argues that, in part, the record industry kind of got missed the point of music. That when people bought albums back in the 70s, it wasn't just about the music. It was about the whole experience of the cover and the liner notes and the neat art. And as things went through the evolution into CDs and then into online MP3s. It increasingly lost that romance, and so that's part of the explanation. The return to vinyl is it's not just about the music, and there's a lot of people out there who sit back and say, oh no, it's the sound, it's so much better, but others say that there's psychology at play here that goes beyond kind of an ability to recognize sound.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I remember you got your record when they started having lyrics included mm-hmm. in the sleeve, but then in the age of CDs, you buy that and you'd unfold the thing to read the lyrics, and the print was so tiny because it was so small. But on the record, of course, it was easy to read, and mm-hmm. the artwork, became a uh, what would a group put out next for their next cover or and that kind of thing. Now, go ahead.
A part of this too is this. So it's about vinyl. It's about analog, but it's also kind of a pushback on efficiency is everything, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a mentality that kind of grew over the last decade and more. That if it was a more efficient way of doing things, it was a better way to do it. Now, people are sort of sitting back and saying, well, I'm not so certain about that. Because when you think about records, they are inefficient, right? They take up more storage space, they get scratched, they have surface noise. You want to hear a particular song, you got to move the tone arm to find it. You know, it all these stuffs are compared to, Spotify, which you just call up the song you want and suddenly you got it. Another interesting part of that is like I say, that it's not just the consumers, the people listening to the music that have jumped onto this, but it's also the people who produce the music. So you're seeing increasingly people, like Jack White and Arcade Fire and others that are gravitating to old ways of recording, the way they used to record albums back in the 50s and 60s, using tape. And rather than software in a computer, which is so much more efficient, you can move stuff around and have infinite number of tracks. So these people, they're gravitating to machines that are hard to use, expensive to use. The tape's expensive to use because they're convinced that it sounds better, and they like the tactile experience of working with those controls rather than looking at a computer screen. And I talked to a fellow in Hamilton who's totally on this bandwagon. His name is Dan Edmonds. He used to be the singer of a group called Harlem Pepper. They were quite successful, and he's having quite a successful solo career. And he's gravitated back to using a 8-track player that was actually found in somebody's garbage, if you can imagine. They took this thing and spent a lot of money fixing this up, and he just loves it, and he's convinced that's the way to go. So he's using technology and also the recording machine, but also other aspects of other boxes that you need that are retro. To record that would not be out of place in a recording facility back in the 1960s.
Now, I get the in terms of creating that music. I'm not a musician, but I can understand that tactile experience, that sense of creation, that they're using old levers of production to make these things. Now, but you're a musician. You have a great ear for obviously for music and all that. So in your opinion, when you listen to records versus digital. I mean, do you hear the difference? Do you think it sounds better or different to your ear?
Well, I maybe go against the grain a bit. I'm not willing to give up on digital. I'm not willing to give up on digital as a means of recording because I feel that I can extend my reach so much further with digital.
Right.
I'm just not willing to give up on that. And as a listener, I like to think that I listen to music as a musician would. So I'm not really so caught up in the feel. I'm listening to the notes and how the song was put together. I'm listening to how interesting the idea gets developed. So I don't so much get caught up in this warmth that may or may not be there.
And just briefly about the HMV thing. So HMV going out of business, correct? I suppose to some, this would have been a sign over the years as these record stores are closing down HMV, that it was a sign that records had gone by the by and CDs had gone by the by.
Yeah.
And now the Sunrise thing, maybe this is a blip or maybe this is something more, or I don't know. What do you think?
Now, some people look at the HMV and they say, well, no wonder they went out of business because they gave up on, they were sort of giving up on music. If you walked into an HMV store in the last few years, you'd find that the musical choices were pretty limited. You would also find that DVDs were taking up a lot more shelf space. So in terms of the chance of you having a fun experience going through record bins, It was pretty unlikely.
Right.
Through HMV. Yeah. They had a limited number of titles. They tended to focus on the real big sellers and the best ofs and that kind of thing. You know, just a minute ago, I was saying that, you know, I'm not quite willing to give up on digital. However, nobody likes going into record stores more than me. I have spent hundreds, thousands of hours of my life going through record stores. I like nothing better than going through the bins, whether they be vinyl or CD. I like nothing better than discovering something that I didn't know about before I walked into the store. So the, you know, the return of the record store is a something I think is fantastic.
So records now, and who knows, maybe the return of shag carpeting and fondue and all that stuff? Is that next?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. When's this? How big is this thing going to get? Who knows? It's hard to say. But I think that the backlash against computers is interesting for sure. And, you know, I don't know how far that goes. Do we all end up, living out in the land somewhere with, maybe we give up on computers today, maybe it's electricity tomorrow. You know, it's, we'll see. Clearly, some people will go that extreme. But it's hard to say where this will end up.
Right. Well, I guess the beat goes on.
It does.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Hey, thank you.
Now I'm sitting down with Jim Poling, managing editor at The Spectator. Jim wears a number of hats at the paper in terms of his role. One of them is helping the reporters navigate the waters when it comes to potential legal issues such as libel and defamation. And a topic of particular interest to Jim is the use of unnamed sources by Spectator journalists in their reporting. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks, John. Glad to be here.
Now, recently in the news, we heard of Donald Trump railing against the Washington Post for using unnamed sources in their reporting. I think he said 6 or 9 unnamed sources or something like that. He suggested it was proof that this had been fake news. Now, as it happened, the reportage, led in part at least to the resignation of his national security advisor, Michael Flynn. We'll get into the Spectator's specific policy with respect to unnamed or anonymous sources in their reporting, but just first of all, I thought I'd ask, do you think that the Post was justified in using anonymous sources in this instance that led to this blockbuster resignation?
It's an interesting question, and it's an interesting topic, John. I don't know the specifics of the Washington Post sources and how they came to their reporting. Mm-hmm. They're a credible organization. They do some very deep reporting. They have a long history of it. So, I trust their editors and their reporters, frankly, to do the right thing. Now, that's a big conversation, and to do the right thing is based on practices, establishing credibility, what kind of reporting they've done and what kind of background they're looking at.
Right.
It's a tangled conversation.
Right. You've had an interest in this topic for many years. I think for people of a certain generation or even maybe the newer generation, Deep Throat, Watergate, the whole notion of using secret sources, unnamed sources in stories or maybe not even in the stories, but using them to get information and so on. There's a long and colorful history, and people, I think, find it interesting in terms of how these things are navigated. How has the Spectator's policy on this evolved over the years, would you say? Did there used to be a policy?
Well, there never used to be a policy. We do have a policy. We've had one for several years. But let me take listeners just through some of the terms you're using. It's very interesting. People will use these terms, and I don't know that they're necessarily aware of what terms they're using. And frankly, I find that in the research I've done, reporters sometimes aren't aware. So you've used background. You've used anonymous source. There's a confidential source. There's a number of ways of descriptors here, and they all mean, frankly, different things.
Right, right.
And a lot of it comes out of a natural tension. Reporters want to get information. You know, that they're out on a scene, it's breaking, it's quick, it's frenetic, it might be a fire, it might be, something political, or they're running down a hallway, or the story, the information is changing. Reporters just want to get the information and report. I understand that. In 2017, though, we have a new we have a new people expect more out of their information, and we have new pressures on credibility, transparency, and disclosure. So while reporters want to get their information, people are also demanding, how do you know that information? How do you know it's true?
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, how can I trust what you're saying? So when you ask me about the Washington Post, I trust the Washington Post because they have a history of credibility.
Right.
I trust them to do the work that I think needs to be done to use a confidential, anonymous, or background type source. But they mean different things, and what has changed in our profession is the law in Canada. The law now gives a partial shield around some of the information. So it used to be that if we were sued, if someone brought media to court, we didn't have any protections. We now have protections around using confidential sources. It's on a case-by-case basis, but we have to demonstrate that how we arrived at that confidentiality pact was arrived at thoughtfully and responsibly. And there's a test that the court lays out for.
On whether we have to reveal the name of that source, say, to the court. Is that when you're talking about protection?
Well, how to reveal that name, or how we arrived at giving that source confidentiality.
Right.
So the court says, okay, we believe that a free press, certainly in Canada, is fundamental to democracy. Press has to be able to go out, media has to be able to go out and suss out information and report in the public interest. And the Supreme Court now says, if you do that and you do it responsibly, we will give a reporter or media organization protection from going to jail or being fined, or we won't be oppressive to go in and so the state doesn't take apart their notebooks and their reporting to reveal and disclose to that person. In some respects, it marries some of the whistleblower legislation with what we do as with journalism. Mm-hmm. But the court has said, if you give somebody confidentiality, you have to assure that source of confidentiality. So you have to have the conversation. It's not, so if you and I were talking and you say, hey Jim, this information's off the record, I have to say, okay, stop. What does that mean?
Right.
What does off the record mean? Does it mean, what if your information is not true? Are we then off the record?
Mm-hmm.
Or what if you've lied to me? What if the information has changed? What if I'm compelled to reveal my source? So can I tell my source to my editor, my publisher? Can I reveal it to a priest?
Mm.
What if a judge asks me?
Mm.
And a judge says, okay, Mr. Paul, I need to know your source. And I say, well, I told that person that I would protect them. If I haven't told that person that I'd protect them, then we don't have a pact.
Right.
So the first step that has to be made is you have to know that there's a confidential arrangement.
Right.
And then the court will look and they'll say, okay, how important is anonymity? So if we reveal the whistleblower's identity, will that subject that person to harm? You know, professional harm, personal harm, will cause them financial harm,
mm-hmm.
you know, embarrassment, all those things. So they need to know that confidentiality clause is crucial. Fundamentally, the court also wants to know that information is in the public interest.
Right.
Sometimes source information comes forward and it advances a political or a personal agenda for somebody. And that's not good enough. It has to be, there has to be a larger play. And the final point the court will want to know is the sources, the information the source is providing is of such great public interest that outweighs the state knowing who the source is.
Right, right. In an investigation of some kind, police investigation or what have you. Yeah.
Sure. You know, whether there's public harm or you know, a town well water is being poisoned,
mm-hmm.
or, I mean, there's any number of examples. So
right.
The important part for journalists is that there's a test that has to be met. Now, to run through those essentially four criteria, imagine doing that when you're on the fly,
mm-hmm.
when you're in the middle of a scene, or it's heated, and the journalist understands the pointy head piece of this. Mm-hmm. The source just says, "Hey, man, I just want to give you information."
Right.
Now, there's other that's within a legal framework. There's other pieces that test credibility. Imagine you're out at a fire scene, and you stop and you talk to somebody. The reporter says, "What do you see?" And somebody says, "Well, I heard three loud pops, and then I saw flames." And the reporter goes back and they write that up as color, and they think, that's very interesting, and it becomes a background paragraph. But then, as investigators do their work, they investigate the fire, and they read the news story and it says three loud pops. That might mean something.
Yes.
What was it? Bombs going off? Was it gasoline? Was it with some sort of incendiary device? And they now want to know, who is that person that heard the pops? They could provide crucial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know, is that merely color for a story? Is a reporter making it up? Do they have a description of that person? And it's not just they want to find that person. Presumably that person can elicit information that will help get to the bottom of this.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as an editor, I want to know, did you actually talk to somebody? And if you did, who were they?
Mm-hmm.
Were they wearing a brown coat? Did they have a hat? What was their name? So somebody might say, geez, I don't want to give my name. You say, how come? Well, there might be reasons around that.
Right.
But in order to maintain credibility with readers, you have to be able to show, you have to be able to demonstrate your information is true and that you're being responsible around it. One of the interesting developments with media is people are very good at finding information.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good at finding, disclosing. Information is out there. We're not the only source. So we have to provide the information we can, but also go beyond and show that we're better at providing this information than anybody else out there. That's what really gives us our credibility.
And I guess that's, I was going to say, credibility, competitive advantage over other sources is that, that we go through this vetting process, that there's a lot to that, and it's not done in a haphazard way, which, I guess some could argue there's benefit to the haphazard way too in terms of speed of people getting stuff out there, but that it's putting the Spectator and other established outlets on a different footing, I guess, right, than some of the other.
Sure, absolutely, and I think partly competitive advantage comes from people, when they know and trust you, they're going to return to you. I mean, it's no surprise now when we have large breaking news events, people go to traditional sources of media, mm-hmm. whether it's online or print or TV, they go to who they can trust.
Mm-hmm.
We're not necessarily first anymore. I don't believe we can compete on time. I think mm-hmm. That's a notion from a different day. But we can compete on credibility and knowing that our information is fair, accurate, and responsible and credible. Really, I think that's the new competing platform.
What is the general policy, a reporter is covering a rally or any kind of event or any story, where someone says to the reporter, you can use what I say, but I don't want my name in the paper. What does the reporter have to do by policy in terms of what they can do with that information and what that source's request for anonymity of the story?
Yeah, it's not good enough just to accept somebody's words at face value. The reporter has an obligation to essentially push back, and there's a variety of forms that you could do that. Sometimes it might be aggressive, and sometimes it's simply, well, how come you don't want to tell me that? What is it that you're afraid of knowing? And there's those conversations unfold in different ways. Sometimes people say they have a misunderstanding of what we're doing, and they do ultimately provide a name. Sometimes a description works. Sometimes we don't use a name. We'll use the information, but the person has pointed us to documents.
Mm-hmm, right.
And for me, it's not so much that, for me as an editor, we have to be assured that the information we're putting out is true and responsible.
Right.
In today's, the way media is fragmented, many people will say many things that aren't necessarily true. People don't necessarily have the conviction to stand behind their words, and we really have to suss that out.
Right.
So there is a pushing back process.
Certainly people, in my experience, people are often frightened of the media. They're frightened of how their words will be used in stories. And I mean, I often will say to them, you know, I understand where you're coming from. You know, I can appreciate, you know, because there is this fear. You almost have to sort of put them at ease. And by the end of your conversation, they're willing to have their name in the paper if they've been assured that you're not going to twist the meaning of what they have to say and that sort of thing. So I guess that's part of that conversation.
It is fair. I mean, some people don't understand what we do. They don't understand the media. And you're hearing that. You're hearing that in President Donald Trump's addresses, and he's essentially using mainstream media as a prop for his goals and his administration's goals. And we have to you know, as an industry, make sure that we can say, no, what we're doing is correct, and we're on the right track, and we will continue to ask questions. We'll continue to suss out information, but you know, reader or viewer, this is how you know that our information is true.
Right. Well, the story continues?
It does. It's a struggle. It's a good struggle. It's an honest struggle. And it's fascinating how information keeps changing. There's a lot of it out there. And we just have to keep providing, you know, context and analysis for people.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's been good. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.